With schools closed for the rest of the academic year, we're focusing most of today's episode on education. We'll talk to a retired dean of an education college about the long-term effects on kids of missing 2 to 3 months of school. Then, so-called e-learning has been a challenge for many families, but for kids with special needs, it can be even harder.
For a kid that struggles with social expectations and following social cues, a video chat really makes no sense to him.
And we'll hear from teachers about their experiences of a virtual classroom. I'm Brian Mackey. That, plus an update on the latest coronavirus numbers and the view from the Quad Cities, all coming up this hour on the 21st, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT Normal, and WNIJ in DeKalb. But first, the news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're beginning our seventh week since most Illinois schools closed to limit the spread of COVID-19. Many of us have adapted to our new, more isolated realities, but for those with children, the questions over education remain. With schools now closed for at least the rest of the academic year, we're devoting most of this episode to issues in education. But first, an update on the latest COVID numbers.
Today we're reporting 2,126 new cases for a state total of 43,903.
Governor J.B. Pritzker speaking at Sunday afternoon's daily coronavirus briefing. Except that daily number of positive test results should not be the last word on how far COVID-19 has likely spread in Illinois. For that, we need to return to an earlier briefing from the governor's office, last Thursday, when Pritzker extended a modified version of his stay-at-home order through the end of May. In so doing, he gave his lectern to some of the scientists who created the disease models on which the state is relying.
Mathematical models are capable of seeing what we cannot see.
Sergei Maslov is a physics professor at the University of Illinois.
They can predict the current number of infected individuals, which we cannot measure due to limited testing capacity of the whole country. The models predict that this number is at least 10 times larger than the number of new positive tests announced every day.
Did you catch that? The University of Illinois model says limited testing means there are probably at least 10 times as many cases as are announced every day. So the most recent announced case count of 2,100 is likely in reality greater than 21,000, and the overall tally for Illinois would be nearly 440,000. Most of those cases remain concentrated in Chicago and the surrounding area, but there are trouble spots downstate. They include Metro East, the Illinois side of the St. Louis region, and Winnebago County, home to Rockford. Then there's Rock Island County, home to the Quad Cities. As of Sunday, Illinois is reporting a rate of 2.1 cases per 1,000 people in Rock Island County. That's 4 times the rate of infection seen in counties that are home to other downstate cities like Champaign, Bloomington, and Springfield. Joining us to talk about what's happening in the Quad Cities is Michelle O'Neill. She's the news editor at NPR member station WVIK. Michelle, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. Thanks for having us on.
So what is the situation on the ground in the Quad Cities?
Well, we have only about a dozen deaths between Rock Island County and Scott County, which is that makes up what we call the metro area of the Quad Cities. With, you know, Rock Island, Moline, Davenport, and Bettendorf in Iowa. And the number of cases is around 300 some in Rock Island County and quite a lot less in Scott County. So it's over 500.
And do you have a sense, being there in person, that there is a sort of a hot spot in that area, that there is a greater than expected number of cases?
Well, I was looking at that last week because since the beginning of this, I've been looking at that Johns Hopkins University dashboard, and they've got the counties down now with the color coding. And so I'm looking at Rock Island County and Scott County, which are in this, you know, kind of medium pink colors, sort of moderate. And then right next to us, we have Muscatine County, Louisa County, Iowa, which is home to a meat packing plant. And then just west of that is Washington County, Iowa. right? So there are three counties that have a higher rate per 1,000. I don't know what it is. I didn't crunch the numbers. So, for example, though, the Louisa County, where the meatpacking plant is located in Columbus Junction, that's a Tyson plant, there have been two deaths and 266 confirmed cases.
Wow.
So a lot of people work in and around the Quad Cities and drive.
Sure. And that makes sense. I wanted to ask you about meatpacking. That is obviously a big industry in throughout Illinois and Iowa in particular. And I mean, is that, I saw a story where a union was warning of shortages if safety concerns are ignored. How big an issue is that in your area?
Well, just this past week, the Smithfield plant in Monmouth, Illinois, which is Warren County, south of the Quad Cities, they had two cases, and Warren County Health Department was investigating a couple of weeks ago, and just last week said they're going to suspend operations starting today, Monday. And so I think not just the unions, but the companies are starting to have a concern about it. And there are a lot of immigrants in the Monmouth area who work at that plant. And, you know, there's a concern that there's not good enough communication to those folks to tell them how to social distance and take care of themselves.
You mentioned the Iowa counties, and given that the Quad Cities includes part of Iowa, there has not been a stay-at-home order there, though. And I wonder if you personally can see differences in how people on opposite sides of the river, Illinois and Iowa, are reacting to the threat of COVID-19.
Yeah, I went to watch part of the bridge get put up along a bike path in Bettendorf near a casino. Now, all the casinos have closed in Iowa and Illinois temporarily. But anyway, that the view of the bridge is right there on the bike path. And this was a couple of weeks ago, and there were lots of people out with their families, walking the bike path on their bikes, and some had masks at that time and some didn't. And it was, you know, a lot different in Illinois. The bike paths are closed. There are occasionally people you see walking their dogs on the bike paths anyway, and maybe a single bike rider. But there's a lot more, I think, outside activity going on.
In Iowa.
And golf courses were open.
And I heard people from Illinois were heading over to golf in some cases.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, there were. The Scott County Conservation Board had to make a rule that said only Iowa residents could play at this golf course in Scott County because people from Chicago were driving over because they couldn't golf at home. So, of course, the health department officials that I talked to were very unhappy and said, you're not even observing your own state's stay-at-home order. So, you know, it was the idea that, you know, Iowa to Chicago golfers, stay home.
That is Michelle O'Neill. She's the news editor at NPR member station WVIK in the Quad Cities. Michelle, thanks for taking the time to speak with us today.
You're welcome, and thank you.
Illinois schools are closed for in-person instruction for at least the rest of this academic year, and that has parents and guardians across the state worried about what that means for their kids' education. We're devoting the rest of today's episode to issues around education, and I thought, as one of those parents concerned about my kids' schooling, I thought it'd be helpful to begin by talking to someone who spent her career thinking about teaching and curriculum and related topics. Jeanette Mines is Emeritus Dean of the College of Education at Lewis University in Romeoville. I spoke with her late Friday afternoon and began by asking if parents are right to be concerned about their kids falling behind over the course of their lives because of the in-person instruction they're missing now.
Well, I certainly can understand why parents are concerned. I talk to our neighbors and family and friends, and I hear that. But I think in the long picture, their kids are going to do just fine. Young people are really resilient. Young people forget a lot over the summer. They don't necessarily retain things. So this has been an extra two and a half months. I believe in the long run, they'll catch up fairly quickly and that overall they'll do okay. I really do think that that's where we're headed and how it'll be.
And we talked off air a little bit, and you mentioned you had a personal experience with this idea of learning loss over the summer. Can you talk a little bit about your days as a teacher?
Yeah, in the early days, I taught 6th, 7th, and 8th grade language arts at a small private school in the city of Chicago. And I taught the same students in 6th grade, then I had them in 7th, and then I had them again in 8th. And I knew what I taught them. And the first time I taught the 6th graders and I had them at 7th graders, I was so surprised because I knew what I had taught, and here they didn't know it. They hadn't remembered it, or more importantly, maybe they never really got it. You know, maybe they answered a test right or did an assignment, but that I really needed to go over it again. And then when I had them again in 8th grade, I knew what I taught them 2 years in a row. So it was a wonderful learning experience for me as a teacher, but it also said to me how much students retain or learn or don't learn, but how they do just fine and they catch up pretty quickly.
So does it matter that, or is it helpful, I guess, that this pandemic, the fact that it came so late in the school year, as opposed to having come and had to do this distancing and e-learning beginning in October or November?
Yeah, personally, I think that we were very fortunate that way, because so much of new skills, new information, et cetera, is really taught and shared and gone over first semester and at the beginning of the second semester. It's not that you don't have some new material in March, April, and May, because certainly you might, but you really have the bulk of it early on. And oftentimes in March and April, the students are taking tests, they're going on field trips, they're reviewing, etc. So I guess if there were, to me, the best time for this to have happened, it seems to me that it would be at the end of the school year rather than at the beginning.
Now, there has been some talk out there. I think the Chicago Sun-Times had an article a week or two ago about how some parents are so concerned that they're considering holding their kids back. So if a child was in, say, 2nd grade this year, maybe they'd see about if they could have their kid repeat 2nd grade next year. Do you think that's something that is a good idea? Should people be considering that?
I guess from my point of view, I don't really think that's something that really needs to be considered right now. You know, maybe there'd be a rare case or two where maybe that would be the case. But for most children, they're going to catch up. They're going to catch on. Your good teachers next fall are going to really evaluate and assess where each student is and going to try to meet each of those students where he or she is. I would really think that holding a student back would be something that would be done in a very rare case, if at all.
It seems like the curriculum is so structured nowadays, and you hear a lot about standardized testing and people have these goals that they're trying to meet. I guess if parents are out there who think, geez, we're going to have an entire generation of kids who are at a disadvantage or who are behind where their peers would have been, how should people think about that?
Well, I don't think it's as severe as some people might think. Like I said, it's the 2.5 months at the end of the school year. And good teachers always adjust curriculum. Good teachers always assess where a student is, and then they begin to help that student where he or she is. So let's say if some students haven't learned long division, the good teachers are going to reteach that or teach it for the first time and really help each individual student get that. So I don't think that that's going to be as difficult of an issue as some people think. Curriculum is adjustable and changeable. You can double up, you can speed up, you can slow down, whatever it is that the students need.
And is that something that's going to happen? Do you think an adjustment to the curriculum, does that need to be a matter of state or school district policy, or is that something that happens more in each individual classroom?
Well, I suspect that the schools will talk about it. I'm sure the teachers have already thought about it and will consider it. I don't think it needs to be a state policy. Not even sure it needs to be a district policy. I think your teams and your grade levels are going to have to think about what they want to do and how they want to do it, and then go ahead and do it. And individual teachers will too. But I don't see that it has to be anything that's mandated.
Are there particular kids? I think we know that learning loss is greater if kids come from a family background, maybe where they don't have all the advantages that other kids would. The parents are working a lot and out of the home, or they don't have the technology that people who are more well off have. Do you think there's a greater risk for kids from those circumstances?
Well, it's possible, because I know my daughter's a special education high school teacher. in a district that has about 95% free and reduced lunch, and many of the students don't have access to computers because maybe there's one in the family and somebody has them, or they're out working, or the parents are using them, or other kids are using them. So there certainly are some connectivity issues that really need to be addressed. And there may be some more loss there, but we can just going to have to hope and rely on good teachers that they'll do what they can come next fall.
And I think much of what we've been talking about has been premised on this idea that the school closures will be for the spring and that some normal education will resume in the fall. Does the story change, or does your outlook change if we end up needing to stay at home and social distance again for a significant chunk of the next school year?
I would certainly be more concerned about the curriculum and students learning the skills and gaining the knowledge that they need if we were to go to all e-learning all of next fall and next, or even next year. I think you've really got to do some adjustment of curriculum and going to really have to think through what you're going to do and how to do it. So yes, I'd say it's a different teaching environment if that's the case.
But I think what I'm hearing from you is the bottom line, if parents are worried, that at least as things stand now, the kids will probably be all right.
Yes, I certainly believe that. I mean, I talked to, like I said, a lot of family members and parents in the neighborhood, et cetera, and they're, you know, working hard to help their students, even though they feel like they're not teachers. But the students are getting lots of things online, and they're learning a lot about life right now. They're learning to be with their families. They're learning lots of things, and we can't discount that because that's all part of maturing and growing up and learning as well.
Jan Mines, thank you so much for speaking with us today on the 21st.
Well, it's my pleasure. I wish you all the best.
Jeanette Mines is Emeritus Dean of the College of Education at Lewis University in Romeoville. Coming up, a conversation about special education during the COVID-19 pandemic. That's after a short break. This is the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. As schools rely on parents and caregivers to deliver remote instruction to students, many families across Illinois have been struggling to be both parent and teacher right now. But that transition from caregiver to educator can be particularly challenging for parents of students with special needs. Students with special needs and their families often rely on specialized support services provided by their school district. That could be anything from speech pathologists to one-on-one nursing. But with school buildings closed, a lot of those support services have disappeared. Another challenge has been screens. Some students with special needs can't use an iPad or Chromebook for extended periods of time, making e-learning a struggle for both student and parent to navigate. I recently had a chance to speak with a couple of people who've been dealing with this head-on. Nicole Schlechter is the mom to four kids in Pingree Grove. That's a northwestern suburb of Chicago. Cindy Klein is a special education teacher in the Triad Community Unit District 2 in Troy, which is near St. Louis. And WILL and Illinois Newsroom education reporter Lee Gaines also has been reporting on this. All three guests join me via Zoom, and I started by asking Cindy what her reaction was when she heard Governor Pritzker confirm that the rest of the school year would not be taking place in person.
I was not terribly surprised, but I was extremely disappointed. It was kind of a punch in the gut sadness when he announced that.
And Nicole, what about you? What was your reaction?
You know, I was in serious denial about it. I guess I knew it was coming, but as a parent, you know, you want your child to go in and be able to finish out the school year and have that closure before they move on to the next grade.
And what has the past month been like for you and your family?
So we spend a lot of time together as is. We're a really close family. And so that part of it hasn't been that different. One of the benefits of having a lot of kids is they entertain each other. So that has definitely been a, a bonus to being home is, you know, they're keeping each other busy. As far as school goes, though, it's definitely been a struggle. My oldest son has autism, ADHD, and really serious anxiety, and just really struggles to learn in a e-learning environment because he is much more of a visual, hands-on kind of guy. So it's been hard to get him to initiate work and then complete it. And then my six-year-old is in kindergarten, and so he's still barely reading, also struggles with some anxiety issues also. And so there has been kind of a bare minimum approach from us when it comes to school to get this done. It's been really hard.
And I guess when you need that sort of tactile experience for your education, it's hard to get that in a video chat, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And for a kid that struggles with social expectations and following social cues, a video chat really makes no sense to him because conversationally, he is just a very black and white kid, like doesn't know how to hold a conversation, things like that.
And Cindy, what about you? Similar question. What does school look like for your students right now? What have you changed or had to adapt to?
Yes, we've had to change and adapt a lot. In-person learning is such a big thing. When we start the school year, there's a lot of dynamics that go into your classroom. There's rules and structure. And by Christmas time, you're almost a family, you know, and then to go where we have really no interaction other than a Zoom once in a while and Google Hangouts and so forth. It's very difficult. It's difficult for us as well as the students because as a special education teacher, we are constantly evaluating and reevaluating and changing our strategies minute by minute even. Something that we think might take 10 minutes may take 2 days. It depends on the kid. And you get a lot of that by reading their body language and understanding when they get it and when they don't, whether it's through their eyes or their shoulders or their reactions. And there's just a lot of interaction and dynamics that go into the teaching. And it's very hard to evaluate through technology.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit more about that, the importance of that in-person component? You mentioned body language, but how else does that play into learning with some of your students?
Well, some of my students, even in a small group, I have groups of from 5 to 10 kids at a time, generally. And even in the small group, if they don't understand something, they won't always come out and say, I don't understand it. But you can see if they have that deer in the headlight look, you know, or their shoulders are slumped or they're avoiding eye contact or all these different things that you know they're not getting it. And you can go to them and work with them individually or change your strategy and ask somebody else a question until you can see their eyes light up and you know they have it. You know, it's just the interaction causes you to adjust your teaching and re-explain and redo things in different ways with different modalities until you can see it click, and you can't see it click with technology.
I gather that a schedule and structure is important.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Just as Nicole was saying, there is a lot of structure and a lot of expectations. And I know some of my parents have indicated that it's really difficult and they didn't realize how compartmentalized their child was until this started, that in their mind, school is at school. And when you're home, it's not school, and they're having a whole lot of trouble trying to get them to do anything because they're not making that jump. You know, they're not at school, so they shouldn't be doing school. It's just real difficult for some of them.
Yeah, I got to say, I think those of us who are fortunate enough to be able to work from home are also trying to figure out that balance and how to decompartmentalize our life if we have any success in doing so. Lee, I want to bring you into the conversation. Lee Gaines from WILL and Illinois Newsroom. You spoke with parents of special needs students about some of their challenges. What did they have to tell you?
A lot of what they told me is a lot of what Nicole actually said. Issues where you know, there's a bare minimum approach to learning, I think is the phrase that she used. And that's honestly reflected in a lot of the conversations that I've had with parents, issues around the use of screens. I spoke with one mother in Wilmette whose son also has autism and really cannot spend more than 15 minutes a day or so on an iPad because he becomes overstimulated. And that causes a negative behavioral reaction from him. And then I spoke with another parent in Deerfield, Illinois. Her name is Lauren Kamnick. She has three kids. Two of her children have special needs, very different special needs. So one is more on the physical disability side where he struggles. You know, he needs a feeding tube. When he's in school, he's learning some of the basic life skills like washing your hands and things like that. And then her other child has more of behavioral issues, ADHD, anxiety, depression. And normally he goes to a therapeutic day school. And so we actually have a cut of tape from Lauren talking about how stressful being at home with these three kids is on a daily basis.
If I go to the bathroom for 5 minutes, it's screaming and banging on the door nonstop. I mean, it's, I mean, if you can hear me, I just have this, I mean, it's just constant.
You know, I think Lauren really illustrates another issue that a lot of these parents face, which is that for them, school was a break in the day. It was an opportunity for them to basically have some time to themselves, have some time to run errands, have some time to do things that are not related to keeping their kids alive or trying to educate them, which often I think feels like an afterthought for a lot of these parents right now.
Yeah, well, Nicole, I want to ask you about that. You have four kids.
I do.
I have two, and I, you know, at times am struggling. I wonder, not only do you have to be a mom, but you're serving in that teacher role now. Is that stressful to navigate?
It absolutely is. In this case, I feel almost a little lucky that I have four kids because I'm used to juggling a lot all at the same time. I used to be a teacher, so the teacher thing comes kind of naturally to me. And I'm a special education advocate also, so I work from home with all four kids here on a regular basis. So I've kind of been preparing for this for years.
This is your moment.
Yeah, this is kind of where I'm thriving. That being said, it is really, really hard. I keep telling parents and I keep telling my friends, so families that I'm working with, and then also just friends that are kind of reaching out for support, that your house is your safe space for your child and for you. And then you are your child's safe person. And so in this time of e-learning, when you have to take on this kind of teacher role, I think it's really important that we protect our safe space and we protect our parent-child relationship and we protect our mental health, because my fear through all of this for my kids, for myself, for the families that I support, is that we are coming from this reality of life that everything has to be done, and this perfectionist attitude where we're trying to keep up with everybody else on social media. And now all of this is kind of thrown into our lap, and it is impossible to get all of the things done and be at 100% all of the time when you're trying to work from home and you're trying to be a teacher and you're still trying to be a mom and do all of these things at home that you would typically do. So I think it's really important that we focus on protecting our safe space and protecting our home and our relationship with our child and our mental health. And so what that looks like for you and for me might be different. But I think that's where that bare minimum approach is kind of going through. We are getting done what we're able to do, what is appropriate for our family in the moment. And if it doesn't get done, I just communicate with my team, our IEP team, and let them know kind of what's going on. We're all in the same boat where we're trying to figure out how this is going to work for each of us.
Well, IEP team, for people who may not be familiar, that's the school, basically the teachers who are working on your individualized education plan. Is that, I might have that.
Yeah. So that would be like the teacher, the special education teacher, your social worker, occupational therapist, all of those awesome people.
So Cindy, on that note, what have you been hearing from parents?
Similar things. Some of them are struggling. You know, they have different children in different age groups and different things going on. And we've had to make adjustments. With some of my IEP kids, I've said they're not doing an exploratory, they're not doing science, they're not doing social studies. We're throwing those out this quarter, and they're sticking with just their special ed classes, the reading, the math, the English, to try to keep those skills up and to limit how distressed and stressed out they were getting over this, because they have a lot going on other than school. And we have to be willing to negotiate, willing to give up a little, you know, and not expect so much. If I don't see one of my kids online, that's usually online, I contact them immediately, not to see where the homework is, but to make sure that the family's all right and that, you know, no one is sick and everything's going all right. So we have to kind of prioritize differently than we would if we were in a different situation.
Lee, have we heard anything from local or state leaders about supporting families and students as they continue to try to figure out e-learning?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Illinois State Board of Education came out earlier this month with recommendations, so best practices for remote instruction, including best practices for remote special education instruction. But they're really these kind of guidelines, right? So it's really up to each individual district, each individual school, each individual teacher to implement these practices. But a lot of it, I think, is really trying to find what works for the parent and what works for the student. That, I mean, special education by its very nature is not a one size fits all type of situation. It's really an individualized education for these students. So how does that work out? And I think it's going to look very different based on the socioeconomic status of the families involved. You know, I spoke with a parent. She and her wife are both essential workers. They have a toddler and they have a seven-year-old son with autism. And, you know, she works days, her partner works nights, and like barely any learning is happening in the household because of that situation. So, you know, even though there are these best practices floating out there, how they're getting implemented, you know, who knows? It's going to look very different from each family to, you know, the next family.
And Cindy, we've been hearing a lot now recently about regression in students or learning loss. I'd imagine that's a concern of yours as well.
Yes and no. Yes, it is a concern. A lot of our students regress just over the summer. So this, of course, will compound things, but all the students are in the same boat and the teachers are just going to have to pick up wherever they happen to be in the fall and take them from where they are to where we need to be. We have to adjust.
And Nicole, I wonder, what are your concerns for your son when students go back to school?
I have to agree with Cindy. I obviously, all as a parent, you're always concerned about regression. For my son, we were already seeing a little bit of regression prior to this. So it's definitely a concern. What we've been focused on is kind of maintaining the skills that he has. Everything, all the progress that he's made this year, we're really focused on just maintaining that. So that we're not worried about learning new skills or pushing him further, just really focused on mastering the skills that he's gained so that when we go back in the fall, we're not relearning everything that we've learned this year. We're just kind of moving forward.
That is Nicole Schlechter. She's a mom of four. Her oldest son learns with autism and ADHD and anxiety. We've also been speaking with Cindy Klein, a special education teacher at Triad Community Unit School District 2 in Troy, and Lee Gaines, education reporter for WILL and Illinois Newsroom. Thank you all so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you.
Welcome. Thank you.
Coming up, we check in with teachers about what their experience of e-learning has been during the coronavirus pandemic. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do so at 800-222-9455. Our number again is 800-222-9455. You can also tweet us at 21STShow. That's 21st Show. More to come after a break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Earlier this hour, we heard from a teacher of special needs students and some of those challenges that they're facing. We wanted to bring more voices into that conversation and get some additional perspective from other educators around the state to hear what a typical school day looks like now when students cannot be together in the classroom. I'd like to begin by welcoming back Kankakee School District 111 Superintendent Janera Walters. Christina Kinslow also joins us. She teaches preschool at Triad School District in Troy in the southern part of the state outside St. Louis. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. This is Dr. Walters.
Thank you for having me. It's Christina.
Yeah. And we're also joined by Dan Hartman. He teaches fifth grade at Du Bois Elementary School in Springfield. He was a finalist for 2020 Illinois Teacher of the Year. Dan, welcome to the 21st.
Hey, thank you so much for having me on.
So, Superintendent Walters, I want to begin with you. What does a typical day look like for you now?
Well, right now I'm at the high school. So, like, I don't know how to describe it. It's the same, just less intense. So I still go from meeting to meeting. Rather than going from meeting from one building to another, I'm going from my phone to the computer on Zoom meetings. I do occasionally come into the building because we are providing meals and we still have construction going on. So there are things that are still going on in the building that I need to monitor. But most of what I'm doing is planning and organizing our future, which we know will look very different from the way things have been in the past in education.
And Dan, I understand that 50% of the students at Du Bois are low income. I wonder if it's been a challenge to try to set up virtual learning for kids who perhaps don't have access to computers or internet or other devices like that at home.
Yeah, I would say the most challenging part, actually, let me backtrack real quick. The 50% is maybe even a very conservative estimate. I think it's closer to maybe 70, between 70 and 80%. But to answer the question directly, yes. There are a lot of them who not only has it been a challenge to be able to connect with them, but it's been a challenge to get what they need. Like the district immediately jumped on the idea of how do we disperse technology. So for our school, we're a one-to-one school. So every student has an iPad in the classroom. And there is a model for that in Springfield, what it looks like for our students to take their devices home. One of our schools is Lincoln Magnet School, and they do take their devices home, Google Chromebooks, but a lot of the other schools are iPads. So the district worked hard and fast to get iPads distributed to all the students who otherwise weren't going to have access to that. And then comes the idea of internet access. So it wasn't enough to try to get the device in their hand. We also had to find out if they were able to use the device at home. So they worked with, I think, Comcast is the local internet provider who was going to provide internet service for these low-income families in our district, at least for a 60-day period for free. But I suspect that that'll change as the situation changes. And so they provided hotspots, along with the school district providing the devices. So that was an interesting rollout, interesting to say the least.
So do you feel like what share of your kids are you able to connect with on a regular basis? Is it most of them or some of them? Or
I have 20 in my class. My wife is also a teacher there, and she's got 24 students in her room. So just individually in those rooms, when I do like a Zoom call, for instance, like what we're doing here today, I would say a good day, if I'm sitting back and being really honest about it, is if I see half or more of my kids. So I might get six students that log in on a particular Zoom call. But on last Friday, for instance, I had like 12 of those 20 that were able to log in. And so really our job, education-wise, and I don't think it matters if we're talking a classroom teacher or an administrator in any capacity, is just continuing to cultivate and nurture those relationships. And so that's where a lot of them I don't want to say fall through the cracks, but I'm not sure a better way to say that. But that was true in the classroom as well. So it's not just unique to distance learning. It was in the classroom too. If we're not super intentional about those relationships, it's going to be really easy for some of these kiddos to just fall off right now. So that's where I think the biggest heart tug is coming from right now, is just working double time to figure out how do we keep that connection.
And Christine, I want to bring you into the conversation. You teach preschools, and I wonder how do you teach preschoolers virtually? I imagine that is presents its own unique challenges.
It does. Our job is really all about building routines and establishing that from a young age. So when you rip the routines right out from under these students from any age, really, it makes it very difficult for them. And so really my support for them is just trying to help the parents find a consistent routine at home and trying to support the parents in any way possible. We sent home choice boards, which are basically just a list of activities, and they choose a couple to do each day. But really, I tried to put the emphasis of control into the parents' hands and let them kind of do the activities that they feel comfortable with, because at our age with our students, they can't just sit in front of a computer to do activities independently. So the problems we're seeing are making sure the activities are doable for parents and that they feel successful with it, and really supporting them more than just the students alone. So they have to have help with everything. So that's something that's really important to me, is supporting the parents as well.
Yeah, and as a parent of two young children, I can appreciate that. I imagine that part of what you're doing as a preschool teacher is just teaching people how to be students and how to be good people. And how do you inculcate that over Zoom?
Honestly, I don't do whole class Zoom lessons, because I cannot even imagine the chaos that would ensue with 20 preschoolers on a Zoom call. I do small group ones with 4 to 5 students, and they're optional, again, to help the parents not feel overwhelmed. And we spend that time doing what we call play dates. So we share, we take turns. I try to always talk about how are you feeling? Are you, what's going on in your mind? And then we do a fun interactive activity. So we're trying to instill those things. And I share activities every day that are social emotional components. And that's part of our choice board. It's not just about letters and numbers. A lot of the activities include drawing a picture of something that makes you feel sad, record a video and send it to a family member that you miss. I really try to encourage the parents to be open with their children about how they're feeling as adults, and asking the children how they're feeling, because there are a lot of emotions for everybody right now. And that's really the most important thing to be paying attention to. Mm-hmm. We can make up the letters and the numbers, but we can't make up is that trauma that the brain is feeling from all of this collective trauma we're all going through. So really focusing on that is my main priority.
So how about that idea, Superintendent Walters? How are you checking in with students? Is there a challenge not being able to see them face to face?
Honestly, we call it learning anywhere, anytime. We don't call it e-learning, because we've been a part of a pilot through the state called competency-based education. And so we didn't struggle as much as maybe other school districts would have struggled, because this is our second year having what the rest of the state's calling e-learning. So we're not struggling in terms of the systems, because the systems have already been in place. But what we have had to do is we had to figure out a way to make sure 99% of our kids were checking in. So the first week, all we did was a process of making sure students were logging in, checking in, and saying, yes, I'm here. Then the next week, we had to go into a system of making sure the students were doing their work, because they were logging in and going back to sleep. And so then we had a system that we created, red, yellow, blue, and green, for our younger students, 0, 1, 2, 3, and it was assigned to a percentage of work completion. So now my son's a junior high student. So when he saw in his online grading that he had a 1 or a 2, he immediately did his work, and then they went up to 3s. And so that was the next step. The step that we haven't transitioned to is grading. So in our mind, we had to kind of analyze what are all the things that need to happen for a student to be successful in this learning anywhere, anytime process. The other thing is that we have our resource officer knocking on doors, not because students are in trouble, but because the resource officer is out in the community anyway. And so she'll knock on doors and say, we're just checking to see if you're okay. Your student hasn't checked in today. And so that increased our numbers of students that were checking in and completing their work. So it really was just a process of analyzing what does it take to learn and breaking it down to what needs to happen in this situation so that we can engage all of our students in some way.
So Dan, when it comes to trying to engage your students with, I imagine you had lesson plans that you were thinking of doing in the classroom for the rest of the year. How have you had to change that for going with virtual meetings with students? And have you had, I mean, was this a district-wide thing or was it something you were more on your own in crafting?
Yeah, so definitely there's the expectation that that teachers will have lesson plans. I guess the interesting thing about this is I try to look for, as I'm sure most people in education do, we always look for the good, like what good can we make from even a crummy situation, whether it's forced on us or not, like this one happens to be. And so in our district there, I think, which is similar to every other district, there are different curriculums that, you know, the district has adopted and paid for and their board approved and research backed and based. And so, you know, in the classroom in a typical day, we'll go through, you know, for math, for instance, it's the Envision learning curriculum and our ELA stuff for reading and writing. It was the units of study for both reading and writing. And so there was always a little bit of flexibility in things like science and social studies, especially at the elementary level. So now, as I'm thinking about that, trying to find, you know, if there is something good to come of this or a silver lining, because of this situation that we're in, where we're trying to do e-learning or home-based or distance, whatever you want to call it, there actually is a little bit more freedom and flexibility to say to my students. In fact, what I said to them last week as we kind of rounded into closing out the second week and going into the third week of this hopefully very temporary reality, but nonetheless where we're at, I said, I want to know what you're passionate about. And we've tried to do that in our classroom anyway. I know other teachers in the district would echo this sentiment, where I start the year with a simple question to them. I say, can you define learning? So in my fifth grade classroom, the students and I will come to what they think learning is. And you get, you know, consider probably pretty typical responses from fifth grade kiddos who will say, well, it's coming to school and, you know, doing a math lesson or reading. And then that always evolves. And we get to a point after about a week of the school year where they're saying, well, learning can happen anywhere. And actually it does happen anywhere. And so once they realize that they're learning no matter where they're at, in fact, oftentimes out on the playground and just observing some sort of phenomena, you know, or looking for patterns and leaves and pine cones and things like that, that's where they start to get that, hey, all of this stuff is connected. In fact, we shouldn't be siloing a 60-minute reading block and a 60-minute math block and things like that. Right. There is an interconnectedness to that. So at our school, we've had this STEAM push for about 4 or 5 years, and I've been blessed to be a part of that, where I not just have a voice in that, but we're exploring together as faculty, like, what would that look like in a 120-year-old building to try to integrate curriculum to, like, really go full bore? Because it looks different.
Yeah. So I'm sorry to cut you off. We're running out of time here. And I did want to ask, and I think I'll put this question to Christina. What are you hearing from parents? You mentioned, you know, supporting parents. And I think that, you know, in order for kids to learn, you have to have, at this time, especially younger kids, you have to have that buy-in from parents to get them to sort of encourage this. What are you hearing from parents as, you know, in about 30 seconds we have remaining?
A lot of parents are overwhelmed and are feeling a lot of what they would call parent guilt. And I feel that too as a teacher. You know, nobody quite feels like they're doing as much as they should be doing. And I feel like that's because we're so tied to our, you know, how unproductive we're being because our world is so different. But I always try to encourage them that anything that they're doing is great, and that just being there for their student and trying the best to get through the day is really what is important, and that nobody, teachers or parents, should be feeling guilty for anything. You know, if you have to put your child in front of the television for a little while, that's okay. And I just want to stress that to parents across the state, everywhere, that we are getting through this the best we can. And as long as you're showing up and doing the best you can for your child, that is really all that matters. There's a lot to take care of every single day, and it won't get done every day.
We're going to have to leave it there, I'm afraid. That's Christina Kinslow. She teaches at Triad School District in Troy. We also spoke with Janero Walters, superintendent of Kankakee School District 111, and Dan Hartman, who teaches fifth grade at Du Bois Elementary. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening.